The only other thing I guess I would say about video discs is you heard in the introduction, I had a little experience in television production and helped out making a few other things along the way. This process of creating this disc has been the most agonizing and complicated and difficult technical chore I've ever faced. It really was very demanding. That has to do in part with the need to put single frames down very cleanly on a videotape that's used for the master. And it partly has to do with other rigorous demands that are connected with keeping those frame numbers squared away and everything. It's actually sort of hard to do. So that's the remarks. Are there questions? Again, let me say, for heaven's sakes, I'll be here all day and this evening, and nothing would please me more than to let anyone who's curious play with the machinery and run the buttons and take a much closer look at it. I'd love to talk about it. Any short-term questions?
Just for curiosity, who decided to put the clean frame first and the frame with the text on it afterwards, which to me seems backwards?
Oh, I suppose it was somebody like me with a great and abiding affection for a picture. I guess I think the picture is the document and the caption is secondary to it.
That's why it seems to me the caption should come first. But
well, you'll have a chance. Make a disc that way yourself.
You can't run the disc backwards, right?
Pardon?
Frame by frame backwards.
Exactly. You can step in both directions if you'd like to see it in the other way, although the disc, the frames do unfold in a forward direction. But I guess I certainly give primacy to the picture myself.
Questions for everyone at the end, I think. I'm the last speaker, and I'm going to speak very briefly on field recordings, past, present, and future, a challenge for the sound archives. As we've seen from the previous papers, there have been very many developments and changes in the relatively short history of field recordings. We started in 1890 with the cylinders of the Passamaquoddy Indians recorded by J. Walter Fuchs. And now we've gone up to the video discs made in the 1980s by Carl Fleischhauer and other people. I would like to present some of the physical and maybe ideological challenges that all of these changes make for the sound archives. I think most obviously are the physical changes. A cylinder recorded in 1900 doesn't look anything like a 12-inch acetate disc, which doesn't look anything like a wire. Which might have been recorded about 1950, an open reel tape from 1960, a cassette from 1970, or a videotape, which might have been made in 1980. Because these recordings are so different in size and shape and material, they all need to be perhaps shelved separately in the sound archives and cared for differently. This requires more money, more time, more different kinds of knowledge for the sound archivist. Also, the machines required to play all of these different kinds of recordings are quite different as well. And many of these old machines, cylinder recorders, wire recorders, and so forth, aren't necessarily easily available. You can't purchase them at your local Radio Shack, nor are they easily repairable when they break down. You can't really look up wire recorder repairer in your Yellow Pages. Cylinder recordings were never really capable of the same kind of fidelity that we can get from today's tape recordings, but the cylinders in the sound archives suffer from many other problems as well. In many cases, they've been played frequently, which has worn out the grooves. They've been stored improperly, which might precipitate the growth of mold. They've been handled carelessly, which causes breakage. Old tape recordings become brittle and they break whenever your machine fast forwards or rewinds or sometimes even starts or stops. Acetate on acetate discs or tapes tends to peel off over the years, leaving your sound in little shreds on the floor, which is not a solvable problem. As we've heard, field recordings are often made under very versus recording conditions, and this does not always result in good sound quality. At the Archives of Traditional Music where I work, we have field recordings which were made in jungles 3 days away from any source of electric power, in the Sahara Desert where the blowing sand refused to stay out of the battery pack, on a street corner in New Orleans with a parade passing by, in crowded houses where babies were crying, chickens were squawking, and monsoon rains were falling on the tin roof. And all of these things certainly affect the quality that you have in your sound recording. These days, many field researchers have fancy Dolby cassette recorders and expensive Nagra machines, but nonetheless, the field recordings have poor sound quality because of the proverbial human error. Some field workers, even though they've spent many years studying their particular culture area, they've taken extensive language lessons, have prestigious grants, they still, unfortunately, are inept or inexperienced when it comes to operating tape recordings. We recently had a collector who did his recording on a Nagra full-track machine, where he didn't realize while he was in the field that it was full-track, and he had turned all the tapes over and recorded the other side. We frequently have collectors who decide to do the music at 7.5 and the speaking between the music at 3.75 inches per second. As their tape is getting used up faster and faster, they change their mind and they decide to do the music at 3.75 and the speaking at 1.875, except sometimes they forget to change the speed. And then they're left with five stanzas of song and only 2 minutes of tape, so they decide to put everything down to 1.875. Then they decide they have to finish the song at the end of perhaps an instrumental tape, which was recorded 5 months ago in another country or something like that. Some collectors move their tapes back and forth from a half-track mono machine to a quarter-track stereo machine. And no matter how skilled your lab technicians are, these kinds of things give them Excedrin headaches when it comes to reproducing the sound on another tape. Field workers are often working in adverse physical conditions. When it's 120 degrees in the shade, they mislabel their tapes, or they forget to label their tapes altogether, or they put them in the wrong boxes. These things are left for the archives to deal with, hopefully with the help of the collector. We recently had a field researcher who was on his way to somewhere in Europe and decided to take a cruise ship rather than an airplane because it would be relaxing and enjoyable. And this cruise ship stopped at 5 different ports for about 4 hours. So this researcher decided to tape and came back to the archives with 20 hours of music from all of these ports. This brings us to the problem of documentation for sound recordings. Obviously, the person who spent only 4 hours in each port didn't have a lot to say about the music of those particular countries. Many of the old cylinder recordings are identified, for example, Indians, North America, man singing drum accompaniment, and that's all we know. Nonetheless, these cylinders can be important because they're the only thing from the 1890s or early 1900s from that particular area. But when we get to cassette recordings that are labeled Indians Out West, recorded while my daughter took the bus back to college, we have something that's of limited usefulness. The basic who, what, when, and where is absolutely essential to the field recordings and in archives, and yet oftentimes getting this information from field collectors can be very difficult. I think field collectors do realize how important it is, but it takes time to write this information down on paper, put it on the back of the tape box, or announce it on the tape, and they have a hard time finding the time to do that. Some field researchers do spend a lot of time, and they will do transcriptions in the before they go and kind of cajole them once they get back, but nonetheless, we are continually faced with collections of probably valuable field tapes, but they are not documented very well, and therefore they do have limited usefulness. If the field collection is inadequately documented, it is, of course, impossible to catalog it very well. At the Archives of Traditional Music now, we index our field recordings by the names of countries and culture groups, by human relations area files, symbols, by subjects, and by the names of collectors and performers. We also have a computerized database of African field recordings that has 15 different points of access, including countries, culture groups, and so forth. And we hope to do more computerized cataloging of field recordings in the future. However, if we don't have the basic documentation to start with, obviously we won't have it correct in our card catalog or in our computerized database. At many archives of field collections and at the Archives of Traditional Music, we do our best to compensate for original recording problems, but we're oftentimes limited by time or money or physical abilities to make miraculous changes. At the Archives of Traditional Music, we spend quite a lot of time cleaning dust off tape recordings which are deposited, unsnarling cassette tapes that have been caught in cassette machines. Some field collectors, if they consider the music on the cassette valuable enough, will carry the whole disabled cassette machine with them and give it to us, and oftentimes we can find a way to get that tape out of there. We use an electronic drive to correct speed on tapes that have been recorded with weak batteries, and occasionally we use an equalizer to try to perhaps emphasize the voice of the interviewer and downplay the noise of the traffic outside. Though, as I said before, you are limited in how much you can improve the original field tapes. One last issue that I would like to speak to is the challenge of legal rights and fair use, which I have seen change dramatically in the last 10 years, and certainly have changed a lot since the first field recordings were made in the 1890s. In the 1890s and in the first half of the 20th century, it was generally assumed that it was the collector who had the rights to all of the field recordings, though sometimes not even the collectors had the rights. If a recording expedition was sponsored by a large institution or by a wealthy patron, it was that institution or that patron who had the rights to that collection. And a well-known example of this is the American Museum of Natural History, which to this day assumes responsibility for the kinds of uses that can be made for the collections that were recorded under its auspices. Years ago, if a university student did field collecting, it was the professor who had the rights to the recordings and not the students. That certainly has changed today. In these early days, it was generally assumed that the performers had no interest in the recordings. The performers didn't speak English. They weren't likely to travel to New York City, where the American Museum of Natural History was located, and they weren't at all familiar with recording machines. As we've seen earlier, this is certainly not the case today. When an anthropologist, Valdemar Bogoris, Mr. Gillis talked about, went to Siberia in 1902, he recorded a shaman and then played the cylinder back to him, and the shaman said, "It took me years to learn that chant." And this little box remembers it perfectly after hearing it just one time. Now, people in remote parts of non-English speaking West Africa love to have cassettes of James Brown and Aretha Franklin. They play them all the time. As we heard earlier, Suya Indians like to have cassettes of Tony Seeger singing. So we come to the question of what should be the role of the present day archives when it comes to the rights of field recordings. What we're doing at the Archives of Traditional Music now is to sign legal contracts with collectors. And the collector may choose option one, which means use at the discretion of the Archives of Traditional Music. Option two, which means educational uses only, no commercial uses, or option three, which means no written transcriptions of the music or the text without written permission from the collector. Back in 1973, Tony Seeger, who was then living in Brazil, deposited a collection of Sui Indian music. And at that time, we simply signed a contract with Tony Seeger because that was our custom, and also because we didn't really know the names of any of the Sui Indians. We didn't know their language. We didn't have any way of getting in touch with them. So we depended upon Tony Seeger to be their representative and watch out for their rights in a way that the Archives of Traditional Music would never be able to do. Also, about that point of time in the early 1970s, a graduate student at Indiana University deposited some tapes of Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys. So at that time, we signed the contract with the graduate student as well, instead of with Bill Monroe, who obviously is and was very sophisticated when it comes to dealing with song recordings and probably makes more money from commercial records and performances than the whole archive staff put together. That was the way we did it. Just recently, an Indiana University professor deposited a collection of field recordings that are from a new African nation. And the songs on these recordings are very political in nature. And if they were heard by people of the opposing party, which is now the ruling party in this African country, those informants would have a very good chance of being arrested and put in jail. So this collector especially does not want us to play the tapes from anyone from that country unless we first check with him, who would know what side of the political fence these people are on. Some field workers and archivists have been claiming that in coming years, particular culture groups are going to demand copies of their music, which they say rightfully belongs to them, and they will not ask for permission from the collectors or sponsoring institutions who actually stole the music from them generations ago. Some culture groups may wish to remove all sacred music from places like the Archives of Traditional Music, which allows disrespectful undergraduate students to listen to this music, and even women undergraduate students to listen to this music. In all fairness, let me say that I have never met a representative of a culture group who was unappreciative of the fact that the Archives of Traditional Music had preserved their music all these years, but I have met several people who were absolutely dismayed at the high price we intended to charge to make a cassette copy of these old cylinders for them. So one of these days, we're going to have to choose a side of the fence to stand on when it comes to some of these issues, and, or at least be ready to negotiate. I'm not attempting now to present any pat answers to any of these questions, but just to say that we need to be aware of these kinds of things, and perhaps through organizations like ours and meetings like this, we can talk about these kinds of things and maybe come to some consensus and some guidelines as to what archives of field recordings from the distant past right up to the future ought to do. If anyone has any questions for me or for any of the other panel members,
I'm Mike Beal. This is a general technical question that all of you could answer from your experiences. Back in the early 60s, the Lomax has put out a series of records in Appalachia, or I should say Appalachia, on Atlantic Records, and did most of the recording in stereo starting in the late 50s. About that same time, Mo Ash made a real nasty statement in one of his albums, castigating, not naming who I assume he was talking about, the concept of making ethnomusicological recordings in stereo, talking about future playback problems, you know, as if we don't have enough problems with wires and cylinders and the little German discs. But what I was, you know, considering, especially when you were talking about people moving around in your space, going on and off mic, as to whether people are doing field recordings in stereo, partially using the point source microphones where you have two pickups in one mic, and that would solve some of your problems, and in later playback, through phasing, you might be able to eliminate some of the distracting sounds by taking, you know, because of its phase relationship to where your microphone is, you might be able to eliminate it and bring out the music that has a different phase relationship. And also the British Soundfield microphone, which you may or may not have ever heard of, which has four elements in the microphone. They are recorded on four separate tracks, and in later encoding, you can pan across, you can put like one microphone in front of the orchestra and pan across the orchestra in playback. And if you want to almost like zoom in on a soloist, you know, one particular violin, by adjusting the phase relationships on those four tracks, you can now eliminate the sounds surrounding that particular instrument. It's not as finely focused and defined as you know, as you sometimes see in spy movies, but are people thinking of using some of these ideas to help solve some of these problems in field recordings?
I can speak to that. Yes, they are. There are some who have whole sets of microphones and use mixers and things like that. There is some fairly sophisticated work being done. And I'm fascinated by that mic. I hope I find out more before the alligator swallows the last time I get hold of it. But yes, I think people are increasingly using sophisticated material, and it helps as it becomes less and less expensive to do so. And I think it's partly a question of sensitizing the students again to take good equipment into the field, because they only come back with something as good as they take, basically.
The Folklife Center has a set of Nagra tape recorders, which include a number of stereo machines. And Charles, with me pitching in a little bit, the two of us edited and produced a record album from that project in the Blue Ridge. And I think this is right, Charles, is it not? Every cut but one is actually a stereo cut. We have one mono cut, or maybe two. There might be two mono cuts. It's a double LP. And we've, here again, I would say, wrestled with the problems rather than solved them. We frequently use a stereo Nagra with a coincident tip set up with a pair of cardioids, which seems to be very satisfactory in a lot of situations. And we've played around with that a lot with even what you would think of as an interview recording, so that we sort of center channel the voice but have rounded ambiance. You almost have to listen on headphones, so it's very subtle. By the time it gets pressed into the grooves, it's pretty well unnoticeable. But our curiosity runs in that direction. The most elaborate setup on that record was not unlike the one that Alan Stoker has given us here, which is just a mixer and a bunch of mics. We went out one evening and recorded a Pentecostal preacher at a tent revival with a band that included, you know, I don't know, a half a dozen instruments and him shouting. And that recording worked out fairly well, although I wouldn't mind trying it again. Since we're limited to two-channel recordings on those Nagras, we haven't gotten into some of that more sophisticated stuff. And I'm not sure. There may be a point there where we run out past the skills of those of us that do the work. And what we would do, I think, would be experimentally hire a specialist to pitch in and help and try some of those things. My job at the Folklife Center involves brokering between our researchers, who are occasionally ethnomusicologists, but most typically academic folklorists, and our operation. And I think I can report to you that consistently, and to me, the most dismaying fashion, I encounter profound resistance to using professional equipment of the sort that we have. It's abundantly and absolutely and totally clear to me that folklorists, by and large, are afraid of the equipment. They communicate that fear to the people they visit, and altogether, the most intense sort of coaching is required on my part to overcome those things. And therefore, as folks get into simply using a mono Nagra and a microphone and a stand-on boom, it's almost a breakthrough. It's really incredible. And I'm not quite sure where the blame lies, but my impression is that, generally speaking, the faculties in the various university programs are themselves relatively unsophisticated about these things. And Alan Jabor, who's the boss of the Folklife Center, and myself and a few others are trying by example to change people's minds about that, but there really is a problem there, and it's been dismaying to us.
Elwood McKee, question perhaps for Frank Gillis. Would you comment on the point at which field recordings and commercial recordings, particularly the early period, might touch on one another, the kinds of recordings that we as collectors, as opposed to field researchers, are most likely to come up against? The example that comes to mind most readily is that many of the Berlin cylinders that were done in the Caucasus were lost in World War II, whereas Freddie Gaisberg's first trip to Russia in 1900-1901 and his Far Eastern trip in 1903 produced thousands of 7-inch discs of ethnological interest, Tatar and Abkhaz and so forth.
When I began this survey, I had first thought I would go into the commercial end of it as well, because there are indeed many commercial recordings destined to be machine duplicated and sold, but it wasn't too long into the project that I decided it was just too large to really work on, and there was enough to just try to get the cylinder and disc recordings at that time. But there are many here in the United States that might be of use to ethnic groups, especially I'm thinking of Polish, German, Scandinavian recordings that were made, and some that were made overseas. I don't think, for example, that these were all mostly studio lab made. They were, as they sometimes did, the first Indian recordings, for example, 1914, 1915, I think there were some two Indians at least brought from Colorado into a New York studio where they made recordings there, and they were issued on Victor. I don't know how much they indeed do have documentary value, but they're not sort of, they don't represent the kind of music these two people would be singing in their own in the societal context. So that they may have, these commercial recordings may have, do have value, but it really would be from the standpoint of they're being made under conditions which were in studios and labs and controlled to a large degree. And of course they would be of better quality than you would get in the field where you heard some of the field recordings made in 1898, 1906, 1908 and such, which were, you have to sort of fight to get the quality out of them. Yes?
Jerry, let me ask a question while you're coming up. I'm Jerry Gibson, the Library of Congress. Carl, I was asked a question in the back of, the video disc is interesting and good and nice. What might be its specific application to sound recordings? Conservation, preservation, storage, and space, for example.
Well, let me turn the question right back to you. Don't leave that microphone. I think for sound recordings, isn't it our impression at the library that we're more curious about what will happen with these compact audio discs and so on, that they're more efficient for that purpose?
Well, the 12-inch video, the optical disc, has the possibility because of size and space. First of all, 12 inches are not going to be quite as easily stolen as the compact size is going to be. And that's a consideration in anywhere, whether it's private collector or
but,
home.
But the compact is digital, and this is still, in fact, analog. It uses right. An analog television signal, so in principle, you should get better fidelity and I think less space on those compact audio discs, which are digital. Right. However, I would add, in our cowboy exhibit, with the help of the Country Music Foundation and Charlie Siemens in the back row, who did a lot of work on this, we have a program disc with 20 songs on it. and you can go to these songs under computer guidance. They perform the job of being a jukebox in this cowboy exhibit. Here again, if people are curious, I can show that, say, at lunchtime. And there's a program control possibility with this that allows an exhibit, for example, to make use of an audio recording in this interactive way. But really, you know more about the preservation aspects than I do.
Well, the preservation possibilities of it are primarily with all the material you're talking about, field recordings, we're talking about magnetics or wax cylinders or acetate discs, basically unique, one-of-a-kind type of items or limited copies. Obviously, you want to, you talked, Louise, about putting them on tape. Tape is magnetic and you've got the same problem all over again. The optical disc, we seem to feel at the moment, it gives the possibility of a long-term storage. Not too many problems with conservation, preservation. The act of playing it presumably is not going to destroy it. Only time is going to tell us that. But that it does give storage capability, preservation capability, and the compactness of it, even if you're talking about the compact disc or using the 12-inch version. We all have space problems, gargantuan space problems, which are getting worse every day. And to use, take this 12-inch disc, for example, I think there was a study 5 years ago that the library commissioned that using the 12-inch optical disc at that time with then existing technology to reduce the... We all have space problems, gargantuan space problems, which are getting worse every day. And to use, take this 12-inch disc, for example, I think there was a study 5 years ago that the library commissioned that... Using the 12-inch optical disc at that time with then existing technology to reduce the speed to play at the best or optimum fidelity, we could get up to 12 hours of sound on a 12-inch optical disc. This was 5 years ago. To get 12 hours of sound on, if you're using your even cassette tapes, you're saving an incredible amount of space in your institution. And if you're talking about collection size in New York Public, or Indiana, or wherever, if you can reduce material that much, you've got fantastic savings in simply paying the rent and paying the utility bills alone, if nothing else. Thank you.
Or I guess this is next.
Concerning the documentation of commercially produced recordings that were made in the field, one thing which some of you may be aware of if you read the Harold Smith booklet I wrote is that the National Library of Canada does have the travel ledgers that they're mainly oriented towards sales, but they do reveal a great deal of information about the circumstances surrounding some of the Victor folk recordings that were made in the particularly the 1920s. We have the travel ledgers there. And then we also have carbons of the recording ledgers for a fairly extensive period of time. If you can consult the two together and other manuscript documentation, such as the kinds of things that are in our Smith collection, you might be able to make some sense out of the circumstances surrounding the Victor recordings, at least.
Mm-hmm. I guess this person was next, and then this
Henry Sapoznik of the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. For Dr. Seeger, I'm reminded by the what you were talking about as far as the technology in the hands of the people who are being studied. A friend of mine who recently returned from Papua New Guinea told me that the latest turnaround is such that where performers are on stage, when an audience wants to hear a performer do another song again, they no longer ask for an encore in the native language, they now scream out rewind. So that's now become the standard for the industry. The question, though, that was being raised here as far as commercial recordings as opposed to field recordings, some of which are overlapped in a time frame, the problem that faces those researchers and archivists of ethnic recording is that for the most part the commercial recordings are the only remnant of sound recordings of especially ethnic communities in transition, immigrant communities in the United States at the turn of the century. These were the only recordings made available, partially or mostly out of a commercial need for sales both here in the United States and for leasing of the masters for export back to the home country. The question then is, do these recordings then lose their value as far as documenting the community in transition at that one particular moment, or in the face of a lack of other recordings, should we then say that because there are no dogs barking or doors slamming on these recordings, do they lose their value as true documents of the culture?
They're absolutely fascinating documents. We've recently been in contact with someone who has a large collection of Greek records, or records made by Greek performers in the United States, or made in Greece and sold only in the United States, mixtures of languages, mixtures of traditions. The sorts of songs talked about it, the mixtures of what people are singing about, the NRA all of a sudden enters into a song about the glories of Greece, or over there becomes a song of reconquest of Constantinople. These are very important and interesting documents for minority groups, and actually for the process of documenting their survival and their growth in this country.
Let me just... I hope I didn't give you the feeling that there was really a value placed on field as against commercial discs documenting a particular culture in time and space, because I don't intend that at all. I think there is no such thing as a better or best or whatever value in this regard. I think they all have their value, given the use that you want to put them to, and the researcher and their knowledge and background and purpose and a lot of other factors. But they all have value, period.
I think we probably have to close the formal questions, but maybe you can catch us later in the meetings for other questions and comments. Thank you.